Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Helena Plott is a young reporter from Alabama with skills beyond her years. She now covers politics for New York Times after working for The Atlantic and other magazines. Often her work brings her back to the South, where she's written about everything from how our gun culture affected her in a personal way to how a Louisiana community was surprised to find out the reality of the coronavirus. Plott threads the needle of writing about hard truths with compassion for everyone trying to sort them out. We're having to fly by the seat of our pants a little bit, so I recorded this from my office, and Elena recorded her in from her place, and we did the best we could. I hope you enjoy it. Here's our conversation. With everybody these days, the first thing I ask is, how are you doing? Where are you at, and what's it like there?
Well, I am in Washington, D.C., and I definitely get the sense here that there's sort of a calm before the storm. Like, I feel like everybody is kind of waiting for us to become the next New York. So I feel like on Monday is when I sort of felt like that ambient anxiety around the city, if that makes sense. So it's not the best, but I'm staying inside. I have a cat, so he's keeping me company. And as I'm sure you are, Tommy, just trying to do the best I can.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask about a bunch of things you've written. I've wanted to talk to you for a while, but especially in the last few days, you had a story out of the New Orleans suburbs, Kenner, about a couple who discovered one of them had the coronavirus and how that affected the people around them. Could you sort of describe that story real quick?
Yeah. So I wrote about a woman named Heaven Freelo, who, like you said, lives in Kenner. And her husband, Mark Freelo, was a 45-year-old lawyer who just came home one Friday a couple of weeks ago with a low-grade fever, to the point that, you know, she was kind of teasing him, you know, like, why are you worried about this? And a couple of days later, it just kept getting worse. So they went to urgent care. They misdiagnosed him with the flu. And before the family knew it, this 45-year-old, otherwise totally healthy man was in the ICU. And he remains on a ventilator to this day. So I really wanted to kind of zero in, not just what that experience was like personally for this family, but also kind of what I was picking up through my reporting and research, digging through Facebook posts about how it really seemed to open the eyes of a lot of these conservative people in the area who either knew Heaven and Mark or knew them through mutual friends or 2 degrees removed or whatever, to start thinking about this virus and this threat differently.
Because many of their friends, and it sounded like maybe Heather and Mark to some extent, had sort of blown all this off as it was starting to happen, as something that, you know, they had been told by watching Fox or whatever was a hoax or was overblown, or you could sort of see the scales falling from their eyes in your story as they realized that it was a real thing, right?
Yeah. And I think scales falling from their eyes is such a perfect way to put it. And added to that, I think there was a spectrum. So I think Heaven and Mark themselves, they're registered Republicans, but I would not call them sort of, you know, Trump diehards who have to tune into Hannity every night. But they're just sort of, you know, the standard Republican that you might find in the suburbs anywhere. But Heaven told me that they were not thinking about the virus at all. Which is to say they weren't thinking about it as being a hoax. It did not occur to them as something that might interact in their daily lives. Heaven told me that up until even the moment that the doctor said, I think we should test your husband for the coronavirus, I mean, she still thought it was absurd. So you have that sort of on one end, and then it just sort of blossoms out as you talk to more people in the community who knew them. I mean, you also had the people who, you know, I cited in the story who got their talking points about the virus from Rush Limbaugh and were, you know, gleefully typing those out in Facebook posts day after day. And that was sort of the ecosystem that the perception of this virus was festering in.
I think there has been a frustration, I guess is maybe a mild way to put it, from people who are opposed to Trump, that people who are pro-Trump or watch a lot of Fox or however you'd like to put it, have this sort of alternate set of facts that they are living with. And to see that this, in this particular instance, that maybe that information turned out to be incorrect, do you feel like, or do you have any sense that that might lead to a sea change in folks exploring some other things to see if their kind of fundamental underpinnings of the way they see the world might be different?
To be honest, I have no reporting to suggest that even people in this community who had their entire perspective shifted as a result of Heaven and Mark's story are rethinking their sort of broad allegiances to the president, because frankly, they don't blame the president for viewing all of this differently before, you know, their eyes were opened, so to speak. I don't even get the sense that they would blame somebody like Rush Limbaugh. I mean, the accountability element is just not there, which throughout my questioning, you know, I was never really able to get to the heart of. I mean, it's just something that really is foundational. And, if this can't shake that, I don't know what will.
You do have something in the story that I think is maybe particular to that area that I had not thought of before, which is that many of those folks who lived down there had gone through Katrina. And the idea of having to sort of lock down again, have to close your life off, to have this huge disruption in your life, seemed to be, you know, terrifying and something that they would rebel against because they lived through it once already.
Yeah, you know, that, and I know you know this too, Tommy, but one of the greatest blessings of reporting is that you're talking to people who are just explaining the world to you and relaying the facts of their community to you in just ways that you would never, ever consider in a million years. But then the minute they say it, you're like, oh my gosh, that makes perfect sense. I was talking to, and I remember that moment, I was talking to a woman who was kind of explaining to me, like, she had been talking to her friends, and of course, they were drawing on their support of the president, their distrust of the media and Democrats as sort of the premise of, you know, why they thought this virus was overblown. But then she added almost offhandedly, she said, you know, you have to remember, all of us went through this whole disruption of life, you know, like our kids didn't get to experience senior year because of Katrina, like all of these things were taken away from us. That of course being something on the smaller end. And she was like, you know, you carry that with you psychologically. And, you know, when you see another threat that could potentially be of that magnitude coming on, your mind just wants to block it out.
You have a line partway through the story that says crises are political only until they're personal. And that felt to me not only like kind of the key line or the anchor of that story, but it feels like to me like an anchor of a lot of the things you've written about over the years. And I have to say, when I read that line, the first thing I thought of was the story you wrote for The Atlantic about the time you got shocked. And I wonder if you could maybe just tell people a little bit about that story.
Yeah. So in September 2018, gosh, I can't even believe that. In September 2018, I wrote a story for The Atlantic about the time when I was 21 years old and got shot in the arm in a drive-by shooting. And
as far as you know, just an accident, right?
Well, just no idea, really no idea at all. I was sitting in a car at a red light and a car drove by me. And then as I write, it felt like my arm was on fire and they never caught the guy or the woman, whoever did it. So we have no sense of motive, why this happened. All of that remains unclear. But, you know, I'd never really written about that experience and frankly had never, I guess, dwelled on it that often. But all my life, you know, I was raised in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and gun culture was just is so sacred there as it is throughout much of the South. I really wanted to use that essay as a way to explore how ambivalence could grow out of even that personal experience of being shot, how I still didn't know how I felt, but having that experience helped me know that like there was an urgency to figure out how I felt about this issue that I don't think that I would have had otherwise. So it was a really, really hard piece to write just because, as you know, it's so much easier to write a story that's black and white rather than one that's gray. But, you know, having that experience, I think, forced me to really probe and try to dig in the particulars of how I felt about an issue where, you know, people are just so sure of how they view it where I'm from.
Well, but I will say that I think in that story, you found some nuance, even among people who I think other people might think would be very hardline gun owners. Your grandfather, who owned and may still own an outdoor store that sells guns, was talking about how there should be age restrictions and that sort of thing, and talked about the sort of hunting culture, but that it may not extend to assault rifles and all that kind of stuff. I felt like there was some nuance in that story that I don't often read in other stories. Is that kind of what you experienced as well?
Absolutely. I mean, it was eye-opening for me even in that respect. I mean, even you can be from a place, but still kind of subscribe to the lazy tropes that the rest of the world kind of lends to it. Just because you've never really taken the time to sit down and talk about it with people. That was the first time I'd ever had, you know, a serious long conversation with my grandfather and a lot of people in Tuscaloosa about how they felt about guns. And, you know, I grew up there and that was eye-opening for me. And so I got a lot of reader mail and whatnot after that story from people who, you know, either lived in an urban area where guns just had no place in the culture whatsoever, saying, I had no idea that people might use an AR-15 to guard their land from hogs. Like it was just something that had never occurred to them ever. They just thought that, you know, you're getting an AR-15 because, I don't know, you're like a redneck and you want to keep it under your bed in case the government comes and bangs down your door. So I was really glad to kind of shed a more particular light on things like that, not just for my readers, but also for myself.
And where would you say you kind of came down on all this? And maybe your feelings have evolved even since the story came out.
I think I'm still kind of where I'm at in that piece, which is that I still don't totally know. You know, speaking of reader mail, I've also gotten a few letters from people who have just said, you know, I really liked your story. It was really well written, but it didn't come to a conclusion. You know, you didn't really tell us what you decided. And a lot of those things I don't respond to, but I just sort of wanted to be like, well, that's sort of the point that, you know, these issues are really messy. And I think it was, you know, Caitlin Flanagan, who I just love so much, who also writes for The Atlantic. She wrote an amazing piece about abortion, how if you don't acknowledge that there is a damn good argument for both sides of the issue, then you're just not being honest with yourself and you can't have an honest conversation about this. And so I do think that that was part of what I wanted to lay out in that piece about guns, that there is a damn good argument for both sides. I still don't quite know which one I fall on. And frankly, I don't know if I ever will entirely.
Is the bullet still in your arm?
It is.
And do you ever feel it, or is it just, you know, psychologically there, I guess?
Sometimes, this is going to sound so crazy, and I don't know if it's just in my head, but sometimes I feel it when it rains. Like, there's like a pressure there. And again, I have no idea if I'm just making that up, but for years I have felt that, like, when it's raining, I feel a pressure, a really localized pressure right where it is. But otherwise, no, I don't feel it at all.
Well, you know, people as they get older always talk about that, you know, they can feel in their joints when it's going to rain or something like that. So it's not surprising that
I feel it in my bullet. It's fine. Super normal.
When we come back, Helena Plott talks about how being from the South helps her on some stories, even when she's talking to Northerners. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I just wanted to take a minute today to thank all of you for listening to Southbound in this weird and troubled time. Thanks so much for your continued support. And for those of you just now finding us, welcome to the tribe. Now, back to our conversation with Helena Plott.
That line about things being political until they're personal also reminded me of one other story I read of yours that I think maybe the first story of yours that I remember, and that was about you and Ann Coulter. That you wrote for the Washingtonian. And that story to me, and maybe tell me different, is about you were growing up a fan of Ann Coulter's, and then you met her and felt a little disillusioned by what you saw. Is that kind of a correct reading of that story?
Well, the very first time I met her was when I was in college and still very much a fan of her. I was not disillusioned at all. You know, I was still crazy about her. It was when I met her after I had graduated and become a journalist that, you know, I felt really disillusioned. And when we were smack in the middle of Donald Trump's ascent in the Republican primary.
And then what do you feel like changed in your mind or changed after seeing her that second time, or sort of describe a little bit about how your feelings changed in that story?
I think anybody in 2015 who considered themselves, you know, right of center, you know, appreciated maybe conservative values or whatnot, was really jolted by how quickly Donald Trump rose in the Republican primary and how immediately popular he was, and really forced it, you know, if those were values you thought you subscribed to, it really forced you to kind of, I guess, look at the party under a microscope and say, you know, I thought that I didn't actually think that these elements existed on the right in a respectable sense, in a way that, you know, like the majority of people would be magnetized by. That is to say, you know, hatred of immigrants, white nationalism, these sort of fringe elements that you thought were just that, fringe, but were suddenly kind of the driving force in a way for the person who was now literally leading the Republican primary. And spending those 2 days with Ann Coulter, and, you know, the reason I wanted to do that was because she had just written or was about to publish Adios America, which is, you know, what Donald Trump cited constantly in terms of his own rhetoric about immigration, his own feelings. And I really wanted to, you know, ask her about that and see how that manifested itself. And I think spending time with her and seeing how all of these things that kind of disgusted me that were becoming central to the GOP's perhaps future identity vis-a-vis Donald Trump.
You know, as you talk about all this, you know, you're sort of describing your upbringing. You grew up in Alabama. Obviously, you felt some affinity with Ann Coulter and other conservatives back in the day. Does that feel like to you? You know, people always think of the media as being this sort of monolithic, kind of leftward leaning thing, especially at the level of the New York Times, Washington Post, those sorts of things. Do you feel like that's true in your experience as well? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get around is, do you feel like your background and that sort of thing make you different than a lot of people you work with?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I guess here's an example. So when I wrote a cover story for Pacific Standard about a year and a half ago about Tangier Island, which is the last offshore fishing community in the Chesapeake Bay. And it's kind of a hotbed of Trump supporters. I mean, the most pro-Trump people I have ever met. And they are likely to be one of the first large-scale casualties of climate change in the United States because of sea level rise. But they don't believe that it's happening. So it was just a paradox that I found fascinating. I really wanted to get there immediately and try to figure this out. They do acknowledge that their island is eroding, but they think it's just that erosion, you know, the natural process of waves lapping against the shore and eating away at the perimeter. They don't acknowledge that the sea levels are actually rising. And I wrote that story, and I got a lot of messages afterward from people in media who I think are really smart and, you know, really admire their writing, who said to me, you know, what I found so amazing about this story was that you were able to empathize with these people and that you were able to hide your own perhaps condescension or whatever. And I just thought that was so fascinating on a number of levels. One, that it would be implicit that I would want to condescend to them. And two, that it's something worth applauding that a journalist tried to empathize with somebody. I just don't think that is remarkable at all. In fact, I think if you're doing your job as a reporter, and this is, again, it's different when you're reporting on a community versus like if you're going in to interview the president of the United States, people in positions of power, it's actually, you know, that's a different language. What I'm talking about are just regular Americans who believe anything at all, and you're interviewing them. Your go-to should not be to explain to them why they're wrong and argue with them. I mean, I see my job as to listen and to understand, to be the best vehicle I can be to help a reader understand what's happening in the world or what's happening in this country. So I don't know. Is that because, you know, I was raised in an area where a lot of reporters right now might implicitly like try to condescend to? Maybe. You know, I grew up in Alabama. I went to Yale. I live in Washington now. I've kind of seen it all in terms of political beliefs and been immersed in those communities. And it's just never occurred to me that I might not be, as a journalist, as open-minded to the fears and motivations and hangups and joys and all of that of one community versus another.
Do you feel like being from the South gives you an advantage in going into those areas that maybe other people wouldn't have?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'd be lying if I said it didn't. I mean, especially like at a Trump rally, you know, when I can go up to somebody and have a Southern accent or whatever, like, I just think they implicitly like seem to soften or relax a bit around me. And a great example of that would be, I was trying to get in touch with Republicans in Michigan because I really wanted to watch a State of the Union watch party in a swing state like Michigan, just to see how people were feeling about the president still. And I got in touch with the woman who runs the Calhoun County Republican Party, which is obviously one of the swingiest swing districts in Michigan. They went for Obama two times in a row and then flipped to Trump. And I really wanted to see how Republicans in a district like that were measuring Trump's performance so far. And you know, in the email I sent her, you know, I always say y'all, just like any email, I use twice, and she responded, and she literally, Tommy, she said, oh, you know, I see that you're saying y'all, that makes me feel like we can trust you and you might not be out to get us. I mean, just that alone. So I feel like that's the most explicit example I've seen where, you know, maybe being from the South helps me engender trust with these people in a way that it might be harder for somebody from Boston.
You know, that's funny because I was thinking about it as a way that you might get easier entree when you're reporting to the South. I hadn't thought about it as a way to also get make things easier if you're reporting elsewhere. So just that y'all loosens people up, you think?
Yeah, yeah. And again, these are people in Michigan. It's not like they also say y'all or anything. It's just, I think that, you know, Republicans everywhere, if you signal in some way that you're from the South, they're going to acknowledge, for the most part, correctly that, okay, you at least have some exposure to other Trump supporters. So maybe you don't think we're all total rubes.
You mentioned earlier that you grew up in Alabama, you went to Yale, you live in DC now, work for the New York Times. And as you said, you've walked in a bunch of different worlds. Do you ever feel like, or kind of explicitly think, that your job is to act as sort of a translator?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, yes, I think I absolutely do. I think one of the reasons I really love covering the right in this moment, and especially Trump supporters, is that I think it's really important for journalists in papers like the New York Times to make sure readers understand that, you know, something that you think is so abhorrent that Trump has just done or whatever is not changing the game, as so many left-wing pundits have thought would be the case from day one of Trump's administration. I mean, right? How many times has it been like, nope, this is when the dam breaks. This is when it's all over. This is when they see that, you know, he's a fraud or whatever. It, you know, I think it's so important for readers to keep understanding what it is about this administration and why these people still feel so devoted to him.
I wanted to ask you about the book you're working on, and that's about George Wallace and a guy that I guess I vaguely heard of but didn't really know the story, a judge named Frank Johnson.
Yeah, so here's the thing, Tommy. This one of the reasons I wanted to write this is that, you know, really smart people from the South don't even really know who Frank Johnson is. I didn't know who Frank Johnson was. And, you know, to tie into what we were just talking about, in that journalism seminar, my professor was Stephen Brill, who is just such a brilliant reporter. And he has been my mentor ever since. And I think it was around January of last year, I was just so burnt out on being a political reporter, covering this administration, the same tweets every day, the same hysteria. And I was a history major, and I had been really dying for some kind of project that could let me dig into archival research and kind of root myself in a time that was not this one. And I was emailing with Steve Brill saying, I'd love to, you know, find somebody to do a biography of. That's my absolute dream. And I'm like, within 5 minutes, he writes back, you should do a biography of Frank Johnson. I did the cover story for New York Magazine in the 70s about him. And then he said, and if you don't know who that is, you're not really from Alabama. And of course, I didn't know who he was. So I like immediately Googled him on my phone and then responded like, oh yeah, of course, Judge Johnson, you know, that's stalwart. But no, the more I read about him, I just thought, how do I not know who this person is? This is somebody who was a federal district judge throughout the civil rights era and effectively desegregated the South. I mean, literally his first ruling on the bench 3 months after he was appointed was to rule in favor of Rosa Parks. And then he was the one who ruled that the Selma March could go forward. So every step of the way, he is, you know, putting his family, his own life at risk. I mean, a crucifix was burned on his mother's lawn. His family was harassed constantly, death threats, because they were really going against what pretty much everyone in Alabama wanted that at that time with regard to segregation, chief of whom was George Wallace. And, you know, I started out, when I was coming up with my proposal, I was thinking it would just be a biography of Frank Johnson. But the more I read about him, the more I became fascinated by his relationship with George Wallace. So this is somebody, the two of them were really, really close friends, both in undergraduate school at the University of Alabama and in law school at the University of Alabama. I mean, great friends, to the point that Frank Johnson and his wife, Ruth, campaigned for George Wallace when he ran and lost for student body president. And I became so interested in how it happens that two people can go from, you know, being so close, really being aligned in a lot of ways, to having such markedly different worldviews. The fact that he had kind of eaten into his consciousness so much was so interesting to me. I mean, to the point that when George Wallace, before the end of his life, had this mea culpa of sorts and really wanted to apologize to everyone, he wanted desperately a reconciliation with Frank Johnson. And Frank Johnson wouldn't talk with him. He said, I'm sorry. I mean, John Lewis forgave George Wallace. All these people forgave George Wallace. Frank Johnson said he couldn't do it.
So are you having time to work on that in between all the virus stories going on now?
kind of. Yeah, I don't.
I guess I was wondering if it is cathartic or relaxing to have something else to think about once in a while.
It really is. I think of it as an anchor in a way. You know, when everything about covering this administration, American politics right now, is about change and volatility, it's so nice to be able to retreat at the end of the day to something that is staying the same, and that I don't have to worry about coming up with a thesis about something one day and having it be totally shattered the next day by new events or a tweet.
People from outside the South are guilty of this, but sometimes we Southerners are too. We treat the South like a foreign country, like a place with its own language and customs separate from those anywhere else. I guess that's true to some extent, but it's also true of pretty much any region, any place. One of Elena Plott's gifts, I think, is to write about the South in a way that preserves that specialness, but also shows the common ground between us and everybody else. We are all part of a bigger group, and that's an important thing to remember, especially in these times. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audio engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.